Welcome back to On the Same Page, where we dive into the top stories in news, sports, and life and culture at The Ithacan. I'm your host, Emma Kirsting, and this week our co-host is Mariana Contreras, Assistant Life and Culture Editor. This week we spoke to news reporter and photographer Kai Link about the pilot program for technology in classrooms, sports reporter Jacob Infault about the Bombers wrestling team and their upcoming competition against SUNY Cortland, and Molly Fitzsimons, Head Life and Culture Editor, about the Eco Village Sustainable Living Community located in Ithaca.
Hi, I'm here with Kai Link, who's joining us again in the program. She's the staff writer who wrote this week's piece on Spring 2024 pilot program to discuss new possible classroom response systems. Welcome, Kai.
Hi, thank you so much for having me back on the podcast. In case you haven't listened before, my name is Kai. I'm a sophomore journalism major. Last semester, I served as the assistant news editor, and I'm so grateful to be back as a staff writer and photographer.
So, do you want to tell us a little bit about what the focus for the story was?
Yes, of course, I'd love to. So, Procrity, the news editor, approached me a few weeks ago and said, I know you're interested in reporting on education. We have this story. I'm not really sure if it's a story. We're looking into whether the college is adding classroom response systems and what they're going to be doing with that. So I reached out to the co-chairs of the Educational Technologies Advisory Committee, Colleen Countryman and Jenna Linskins. Professor Countryman works in the Department of Physics and Astronomy, and Dr. Linskins is the Director of Learning and Innovative Technologies for the Center for Instructional Design and Educational Technology. That's a mouthful. But the two of them lead the ETAC, Educational Technologies Advisory Committee, and basically, it's a group of 15 representatives from across campus, across the different schools. There's faculty members, staff members, and students who all provide feedback about the college's instructional technology and make recommendations about future technology or changes that they should make to technology. And that helps inform the provost's decision and the chief information officer when the two of them are making decisions about what technology to use in the future if any changes need to be made. So I started looking into it. So when I spoke to them, I asked them about the pilot program and what it's designed to do. And they explained that the college uses Top Hat as their current classroom response system. And basically a classroom response system pushes questions out to students' devices. And then when the students answer them, the instructor can see how they answered. So then they know if they need to go over questions or if there's something that students, like they can provide also like polls on their understanding level and things like that. They can also see student attendance and participation. So it's just a tool that's designed to increase classroom engagement. So the college currently has heard from several faculty members that Top Hat is too expensive because students have to buy their own license to use it each semester. And it's not exactly doing everything that the college is hoping to see in classrooms. Faculty said that it's not super intuitive and it's hard to use. So ETAC is working to find a new classroom response system that would allow faculty and students to engage better in the classroom. So they started out with a survey. They asked faculty what they're looking for in a response system. They had a long list of things that they were looking for. They had a long list of classroom response systems. And ETAC, the subcommittee for classroom response systems, was able to narrow it down to three. So this semester, they are piloting these three systems. So they have faculty volunteers, I think 19, who have signed up to test them and get some feedback from students and see if these classroom response systems actually work and if they'll be effective in teaching.
Wow, that all sounds very interesting. So you already mentioned a few people that you gather information with or who you asked about. Do you have any other sources as students or maybe teachers who have been using these programs?
I spoke to Rebecca Brady, who is a professor in the Department of Biology, and she gave me a lot of great information about how she is piloting iClicker in her classes. So she's a member of the ETAC Classroom Response Subcommittee, but she also volunteered to be part of the pilot. And she was explaining that she's seen that Her classes have been more engaged with it. It's been really good for her introductory level classes because she's able to like display pictures and then have students like click on them. She can ask specific questions. If there's questions that students don't get, she can pause the lesson and add questions in the middle of it. And it's been very intuitive for her to add her classroom slides into the iClicker technology and then just like naturally incorporate the engagement part of it. So that was really interesting to talk with her. And then just by chance, I was kind of asking around trying to find students who have actually used the classroom response systems. And I found a student, Sarah, who's in one of Professor Brady's classes. So that was really cool. And I got to see like both perspectives of the matter. So Professor Brady gave me some really good feedback about how she's trying to think about what can support students best. And then Sarah actually told me that she feels that the technology is making her more engaged in class. She's been more interactive. She's felt more accountable for the knowledge that she's picking up in class. And then the other good thing is she feels a little bit more confidence because if she gets a question right on iClicker when it pops up, she feels like now she has the comfort level that she can raise her hand and she can talk in class. So that's kind of cool to see that it's not just increased student engagement, it might also increase student participation.
Yeah, that all sounds very good. So I think sometimes as writers, there's information that doesn't make the final cut. Was this a thing that happened in your article or... could you cover like kind of all the bases?
Yeah, so I did a lot of research on the three classroom response systems that the college is testing. So that's iClicker, Poll Everywhere, and Echo 360 Poll. And I figured out like what separates each of them, if there's any unique features that they have. I looked at like pricing points and things. Some of that's not really like the pricing isn't open on the website, but I was trying to just gather as much information as I could. But a lot of that information is great, but it didn't make the final cut because the story is already kind of long, and that's not the point of the story necessarily, because students and faculty are the ones who are testing it, and so it's more about like their reaction to it. And so I think whatever system does get chosen, then that might be an opportunity to provide some more information on that. But ultimately, I just felt like it wasn't absolutely essential to the story, and I was hoping that I'd be able to include more relevant information from the students and the faculty that I was speaking with.
Of course. Sounds like you did get a lot of that, though. Were there any challenges that came up while you were reporting?
Honestly, this doesn't happen a lot, but I was able to find sources easily for this story, and they were very gracious about meeting with me as soon as I reached out. So it was a nice road, and I even reached out to the provost, and I felt bad it was short notice, and she still was able to give me her perspective on the matter. So this story went really well in terms of finding sources and trying to put it all together. So I was really grateful.
So finally, I kind of want to ask, is there anything that you found really interesting while doing this research? Or what would you think people reading the story is the most important takeaway?
Yes, definitely. I'll be honest, going into this, I was a little nervous because it could be, I guess, perceived as a bit of a boring story because it's educational technology and it's a very formal committee and things like that. But the more I looked into it, I found that there's a lot of interaction and engagement between faculty, instructors, students, and the college administration, which is really interesting. So I think, I guess, the most interesting part of the story to me is how much the college seeks feedback from the community when they're making these decisions. And it's not one of the great quotes, one of my favorite quotes in the article was from Dr. Linskins, and she said that this committee, ETAC, and this whole pilot program is designed to be like a meet in the middle point. It's not top down, it's not bottom up. It's a place where everyone can come together and they can all share perspective and feedback and try and make decisions that benefit the entire campus community. So that was really cool to see that it's not just about like technology, it's actually about making sure that everyone feels that their voice is heard, everyone feels that they can give some feedback to the college. And I don't know, it made me feel good as a student to know that other students' voices are being considered, and that's not something that we hear a lot. Oftentimes we hear about how sometimes administration maybe isn't hearing from all the voices on campus, or there's some people who feel that their voices aren't being heard. So I feel like this was a great example of, I guess, a situation where the college is going above and beyond to try and make sure that they hear from as many people as possible and they collect all this feedback to make sure that everyone, or as many people as possible, can be satisfied with the decisions that are made.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Kai. If anyone wants to go check out the full article, it will be on the website. And honestly, I think myself, it's a pretty good read. So thank you. Have a nice week. Hello, I'm here with Jacob Infel, who wrote this week's article on the sports column about the Itaga and Sonny rivalry that expands also into wrestling. Do you want to introduce yourself, Jacob?
Thanks, Mariana. Hi, I'm Jacob Infel, and I'm a first-year sports media major here at Ithaca, and this is my second semester writing for the sports section of the Ithacan.
Nice. Welcome to the podcast, Jacob. So I wanted to see a little bit more about what the article is about, or what did you try to capture in it?
Yeah, so basically my editors thought it'd be a good idea to look at, like, we all know football, the big Quartica game, that's kind of like the big deal on campus, but like all of the other sports still have like a rivalry going with Cortland. And wrestling specifically, they have a match coming up on the 15th, and they haven't lost to Cortland in a head-to-head match in 9 years, I believe, 8 years, back to 2016. So I think they thought it would just be a cool story to look into like the details of the rivalry, like how that streak got going, how they've been so dominant against Cortland. And I was also lucky enough to talk to the Cortland head coach, kind of get his perspective on things as well.
You already kind of talked about some of the sources you talked to. Are there any specific players that you talked to?
Yeah, I talked to three players. I talked to freshman Jake Jones, sophomore Ryan Galka, and a senior Jeremy Mazzella. And I think it was kind of interesting. Like, they all are kind of into the rivalry, but all at different levels. I mentioned in the article that Jake, he's only a freshman. He's from Pennsylvania, so like this is like a D3 sort of thing. So like he had no idea about this until he came here, so he's still kind of like working into it. And then someone like Mazzella, he's been here for 4 years now, and it's almost personal, this sort of thing. Like, he gets really amped up for this match every season, and he really wants to beat them, especially going on the road in a couple weeks to Cortland. He doesn't want to lose because that's not a good look.
Wow, it really seems like you covered all the bases. Were there any specific challenges that came up while you were reporting?
Yeah, I think it was just a struggle trying to get in contact with the Cortland sources. I was hoping to talk to one of their athletes, but I think it was still valuable that I was able to talk to the head coach. He's only been in the program for a couple years, and so he hasn't been there during this entire losing streak. And I think it was interesting because him and Coach Nichols from Ithaca kind of had a different perspective on like the upcoming match, so I thought that was good.
Is there any information that you found interesting that couldn't make it into the final cut of the article?
Nothing really. A lot of the guys in Ithaca kind of made like the same points overall. So like, even though I wasn't like repeating the same thing that each guy was saying, like overall, I think like I kind of summed it up nicely. They all kind of were looking at it like, yeah, this is a big match, but at the end of the day, it's just a regular season match, and they really wanted to win, but the regionals and the NCAA championships are coming up directly after, so that's the main focus, but they definitely all wanted to get that win to keep the streak alive.
Finally, is there any specific like motivation for you in picking up stories like this? What is what's most interesting as a reporter about the stories?
Yeah, so actually nobody picked this one up at first, and I started out, my first ever story was the wrestling team preview, and then I was comfortable talking with the athletes and coaches on the team, so then I took another story about the wrestling coaching staff, and it's actually hyperlinked in the article that I just released. Yeah, my editor came to me and he said that you've done a great job with the previous wrestling stories and you've built a relationship with the coaches and the athletes, so, and I didn't have a problem doing this, and it seemed like an interesting story because I'm on the track team here, so that's also another lower level sport, so it's like the same idea. Like, we don't really get as much attention similar to wrestling, so I thought it'd be cool to look into like how the wrestling team views like the rivalry against Cortland.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jacob. If you want to check out more information on the story, you can always go to the website and see Jacob's full article. Thank you so much for being here this week, and we hope to have you again.
We are here now with Head Life and Culture Editor Molly Fitzsimons, who is going to be talking to us today about the Eco Village, the Life and Culture Front. Molly, please introduce yourself. Welcome back to On the Same Page. And could you tell us a little bit on what this article is about?
Yeah, so hi, everyone. My name is Molly Fitzsimons. I'm the Head Life and Culture Editor. And So there's an eco village, which is a completely sustainable living community. It has three neighborhoods: Frog, Tree, and Song, which have the cutest names. And there are like three neighborhoods that are all grouped together. They're on about over 100 acres of land up on West Hill in Ithaca. They have some community centers. They pretty much do everything themselves. They farm everything. They cook together. They don't have every meal together, but they have many communal meals. They have events there. There's a comedy event. They just had Sparkfest, which was their talent show. So they're, and it's all ages. It's not just older people or younger people. There are children. There's people over 80. There's people turning 90. There's, you know, young parents. There's just a really wide variety of people from different backgrounds living in this community, and they're all have found a way to live sustainably and, like, in a really nice community.
That sounds really interesting. So I guess my first question following that would be, who did you speak to do your reporting? Who were your sources?
Yeah, so I was luckily able to speak to seven people who all live in the community. They all had different roles. I was able to speak to one of the co-founder. I believe her name is Liz Walker. She was very interesting, very insightful. It was very cool to get to talk to someone who was part of the creation process, because it's been around since the 90s, I believe. I was also able to speak with one of the first residents who'd been there for 22 years, but also a mix of people who had been there for maybe 7 years, only a year, year and a half, all different, you know, roles in the community. I talked to people that were more involved with, like, being on boards and making improvements, and I also was able to talk to Ro Rasmussen, who was a tour guide, which was very cool, and just overall get to really take a look, take a peek into, like, what their life is like. I was able to attend, like, an art showing, I guess, before Sparkfest, which was in the evening, which was the talent show. In the afternoon, there was, like, an art exhibit where a bunch of the residents of the community had a space to show some of the stuff they were working on. So there was a photographer and someone who worked in textiles, and there was these really cute, like, hollowed out logs with, like, a scene with little gnomes on it. It was very cool and very creative. There were also, there's children in the community, so they had books of their art out, which was very nice to see. It wasn't just older people and their art.
That sounds like a lot of fun. I was actually, like, as you were describing your sources, I was thinking, like, man, I wonder if Molly got to go to this place, because it sounds very interesting and something that is kind of a little more like a contemporary style of living. It's not, you know, super typical in the United States, at least. I'm not super familiar with it just generally. So could you speak more on, like, what it was like to go to the eco village? How did that opportunity come about, and could you kind of place us there?
Yeah, so it was originally a walking tour that I had found online. They do tours periodically, I want to say monthly, but only for specific months, and you can kind of just get a peek into what their living looks like. And it's also really helpful for them gaining new residents. A lot of residents that I was told had attended the tour at least once, if not a couple times, before actually inquiring about living there. So it was really interesting to, you know, learn a little more about, like, the buildings. They have one apartment complex building. I'm apologize, but I forget the name of the neighborhood. But it was completely LEED certified, like every other building, but also every single apartment, despite the building being over 4 stories tall, was completely accessible, which is huge. And even though there was a lot of houses, it was nice to see that even the apartments were able to be, I guess, lived in by anyone, really. So all of the housing and everything was very earth tones, which was really nice. There was, you know, up in Ithaca, it's kind of gray right now because of the winter, so there were some houses that were more like light blues and grays, and, you know, some more like, I guess, mountain tones. There were some houses that were more like greens and browns, which was nice, some more like earthy tones. They all, I would say, there were not buildings that really, really stuck out in terms of color, which I thought was a really nice touch, because they want to live sustainably, and they're tucked into, like, this little, like, hundreds of acres of land that they own, but they're also not making it seem that they're there. They're living with the environment, which I thought was a very nice touch. The place where the art gallery was, so there's three neighborhoods, Frog, Song, and Tree, like I mentioned, and each has, like, a common house, which is, they're different sized spaces. The Frog common house was where the art gallery was, so it was a little smaller, but it still had a full kitchen, giant wooden table in the middle. They take turns having meals. There's 2 to 3 common meals every week for dinner, and people take turns cooking. So there's like a team that cooks, a team that cleans. Everyone else is free to just come and eat and not worry about cooking. It's all food that they've locally grown, which was amazing. So that day with the Art Fest had a fondue, which I was told was pretty typical, which I thought was a really nice touch. It was just like a very warm, welcoming environment in the common house. It was very easy to see that, you know, they wanted to be around each other and they wanted to be part of the community, and they had made spaces to make that scene.
Yeah, I mean, this eco-village sounds like a really interesting novel concept, so I'm just curious what made the Ithacan want to tell this story primarily to the campus, and why are we reporting on it right now?
So the last time that I could find the Ithacan reporting on Eco Village was an update when they were building one of their last neighborhoods. I know we have talked to them in the past as well. You know, maybe it's not a direct tie to Ithaca College, but I also think that we often forget how much of a reach Ithaca College has. I actually spoke to a resident who had come to Ithaca College to see Pirates of Penzance and said it was absolutely wonderful and super enjoyed it, but also that the Modern Major General song was stuck in her head, so she went home and she wrote a spoof of it, or like a play on it, and it was called, she was a new resident to Eco Village, and it was the, I am the very model of an EVI new resident. So even though, you know, we are a college up on South Hill and things like that, we still have an impact. I also was told that they have a direct view of towers from where they live. And every year on New Year's, they stand there and they see the numbers change and they absolutely love it. And I was told multiple times that they love looking at the towers for New Year's because they get to see the year change.
I have a friend who goes to Ithaca College who grew up in the Ithaca area. And so like our first year of college, she told me all about like the lights and towers, and they switch it to be the numbers. And she was like, oh, people like fight to be a volunteer to turn on the light. And I'm like, oh my God, wow. So yeah, I think that's really cool. I love the way that Ithaca College tends to intertwine with the community. So it's nice to see that even in the Eco Village community as well, it's still connected with Ithaca College. Was there any information that you got while you were talking to sources and talking to the residents that you found interesting that couldn't really make it into the final cut of the article, whether it was because it didn't necessarily fit in like the angle of our story or because the first draft was just too long, like word count wise?
I think the biggest thing that I wasn't able to include just because of word count was how people decided to live in an eco-village. I have a lot in the story about like why, how they're doing community-wise and, you know, how they're happy there, but there were a lot of stories of what their lives were like before they came to eco-village that I thought were very interesting. Some people, you know, were just interested in being environmentally conscious, so they decided to look into a housing situation like this, co-housing. There were some people who just wanted a community, and this happened to be one that they found. There's some that, you know, their partners looked into it and they went, okay. There's some people who took charge in finding something like this, which I thought was really interesting. So that was one. The other big thing, which there's a little bit of this, but I wasn't able, unfortunately, to include as much as I would have liked, is they have a really interesting system for how they make decisions. They do everything on consensus-based decision-making. So everyone has to agree on the proposal in order for it to be in place. So the proposal, I think, goes to 2 meetings and then they vote on it. And if even one person says no, they don't do it. Now they are given a second chance to like talk and work with that person and say, you know, what don't you like? What do you want to change? And then it'll go to a second round of voting. And if it's still a no, it's a no. They do have a system in place, I believe was only used 2 times in the whole time, which the co-founder told me, which is if it's like something that really, really, really like dire need needs to be done, then it can. There is a second system in order to make sure it's not always consensus-based. But consensus-based has been working with for them for 22 years. It's something that the co-founder started doing because she was part of an anti-nuclear activist group, and it worked for them. And so she thought, oh, we'll bring it here and it'll work for us. It also works for other eco-villages around the country, which is another reason they brought it in, which is part of the article that I wrote. But I will say I could talk about that and would want to learn more about that, like, for ages, because I just think it's so interesting, especially since we're so used to majority rules and so many things that we do.
This article, I've taken a few sustainability and like environmental studies courses here at Ithaca College, so like, and also it's part of like the college's mission that we are making an effort to be an environmentally sustainable campus. So I think that's really cool that we have such a close example, like area-wise, a close example. So I think that's really all the questions I have for you today. Thank you so much again for joining us. Is there anything else about this story that you want to mention that we haven't asked about?
I think just the biggest thing is really my key takeaway was that these people who choose to live in these co-housing opportunities, they really, really want to be there. They love their sense of community they've found. They've come from all different backgrounds. Some don't necessarily have strong connections with their biological family, so they found an incredible opportunity for a non-biological family through this. And I guess my only note would be that I was very impressed with how happy everybody seemed.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. I'm glad you enjoyed this story so much. It sounds like a great read. To our listeners, you can find this story on The Ithacan online at theithacan.org. Thank you again, Molly, so much for joining us.
Thanks again for listening to On the Same Page. You can find more episodes of our show and other shows through The Ithacan anywhere you find podcasts when you search Ithacan Podcasts. You can listen to more podcasts and read the stories you heard today and more when you go to theithacan.org.